Canaanite's interpreter, and one of our own spies. "By my father the god!" exclaimed the queen, leaning forward. "She's dared deceive us?" "Exactly, your radiance. And if you will allow my tale to proceed..."
The queen leaned back, still staring at Mara. "Go on," she ordered. And so the tale was told, with all the eloquence and subtle emphasis on his own cleverness of which Count Senmut had made himself master through long years of courting the favor of his queen. Mara listened with growing astonishment, scarcely able to recognize the happenings she knew so well. Nehere was barely mentioned, the soldiers and Sahure dismissed with a shrug. It became clear that Count Senmut alone, inspired by his pure and lifelong devotion to the Radiant One, had solved the whole riddle in a flash of genius, conducted the raid single-handed, and desired naught for reward save the smile of Pharaoh. Aye, and Pharaoh was beginning to smile.
"Prince of Serpents," thought Mara, almost in awe. It was this same sly, persuasive tongue which for years had twisted all reports into the shape of what Hatshepsut wished to hear, a hymn to her own glory. It was these fluidly gesturing hands, as much as the slim, be-ringed ones resting on the arms of the throne, which maneuvered the destiny of Egypt and her helpless thousands. The black land might perish under taxes or the sword of an enemy, so long as these two gained their ends. "Behold, that which men dreaded now exists," thought Mara. The old prophecy of Neferohu was forming in her mind. Foes are in the east, and Asiatics descend into Egypt, and no protector hears. The land is diminished, its rulers multiplied. Little is the corn, great the corn measure, yet it must be measured to overflowing.
"You, slave!" the queen's voice sliced through her thoughts. "You may address my majesty. Have you heard the charges made against you by his excellency?"
"I, Radiant One," whispered Mara.
"Do you deny them?"
"Nay, I do not deny them."
"What am I saying?" she thought in sudden panic. "I must deny them somehow." "You used your position as interpreter to hold private converse with my half-brother, the Pretender. You bore messages from him to the rabble at this inn, whom he calls his followers. And you were aware, as you did this, that you were assisting a plot against my sacred majesty and the throne of Egypt?"
"Nay, nay, I knew it not. I knew not what I did. I was bewitched. Your majesty, it was as in a dream. I knew only that I must go to the inn, but I did not even understand the words I spoke there. I moved as one under a spell. I swear it was so. His highness, your brother, bewitched me."
"Lies," cut in Nehere contemptuously. "None could bewitch that maid. She's half heft herself. She knew what she did."
"I've no doubt of it," said Hatshepsut. "Come, girl, this babble will gain you naught. You bore messages and assisted in treason against me. However, it is possible I might spare your life if you show yourself helpful now. Name me the leader of the plot."
The moment had come. Mara's lips parted, and her heart suddenly began to pound against her ribs.
"I do not know him, Majesty," she whispered.
"You do not know him?"
The queen seemed not able to believe what she had heard. Then her eyes narrowed with fury.
"Do you dare defy me? Answer at once, before I have your tongue slit. Who is the leader?"
"I do not know him."
There was an incredulous silence. Then Count Senmut spoke harshly.
"Perhaps, your majesty, she has forgotten. You, Libyan, refresh her memory."
Shadzar scrambled off his knees and plied his whip with a will. 1, 2, 3 lashes blazed across Mara's back, already striped with welts.
"Who is the leader?" repeated Hatshepsut.
Trying with difficulty to catch her breath, Mara said, "I tell you, I know him not."
"Est, it is the daughter of Set himself that you have brought me, Senmut," breathed the queen, white-faced. "Question this slave. I will not speak to her again."
"I hear and obey your radiance."
The furrows of his smile carved deep into the architect's face as he left his place beside the throne and advanced upon Mara.
"I advise you," he rapped out, "to answer me while you're able. Who is this leader?"
"I do not know him."
"Double your strokes, Libyan."
Again, the crack of the lash sounded in the room. 4 times, 5 times, 6. Through a blur of pain, Mara heard the relentless voice again.
"Who is he?"
Slowly, but stubbornly, Mara shook her head. She heard Shadzar swearing at her under his breath. The architect rapping out,
"Double the strokes again!"
Mara gasped in protest. Then, in agony, as the lash bit through the linen of her dress and laid open the skin beneath, she felt the linen tear away from her back, heard the whine of the next stroke, and tried to brace herself for it. But the lash was living fire now, and each blow tore through her flesh. She could not brace herself. She could only retch helplessly, try to twist away from the remorseless whip, and grow sicker, dizzier.
"Stay a moment," cried Hatshepsut. "Call off your Libyan ape, Nahere. He'll kill the girl and will be no wiser than before. You, slave, up on your knees and listen to me. Can you hear what I say?"
The room was whirling, and the voice seemed to whirl too. But after a moment, splashes of light appeared through the hazy darkness, swam into focus, and resolved themselves into the torches. Mara felt herself pulled to her knees. Senmut was repeating the queen's question impatiently.
"Can you hear, Her Majesty?"
Mara nodded, sick with the smell of blood and the taste of it on her lips when she tried to moisten them.
"Listen well, then," ordered Hatshepsut. "I will spare you all further punishment for your crime if you will answer the question. More than that, I will free you from slavery and give you 50 gold deben and a silver chain. Think, only a word or two, and you will walk out of this room a free maid with gold in your sash and your life before you."
Gold and freedom, thought Mara dimly. Once I wanted those things above all else. "Majesty," she whispered again, "I do not know the leader."
Nahere's cold voice broke the heavy silence which followed.
"Your Radiance, it is barely possible she speaks truth. The informant I discovered and questioned told of a certain scribe who interested me much. It is said he alone knows the leader. I did not believe this, but if I might put a question..."
"Do so," snapped Hatshepsut.
Nahere turned to Mara.
"Answer me, insolent one, or I'll call back the Libyan. Do you know this Sashai?"
I know him."
"Who is he, then?"
"Sashai, that is the only name I know."
"Liar! You know him well, well indeed, according to that juggler. Was it not he who warned you when his own followers would have killed you? Aye, and was it not he you risked your own neck to save?"
"He and others."
"What others?"
Mara was silent a moment. Then she said, "Those like myself."
"And who is so worthless as yourself, pray? What babble is this?"
"You would not understand," thought Mara, "even if I told you. You do not know those others, but I know them, son of Set.
Nekank and Ashur and Miftaya and Nefer and the temple priests and the fishermen on the Nile and the goldsmiths and carpenters and potters and stonecutters going home from their work in the city of the dead and their friends and kin, they are the others. She understood Inanni's story now. They were her friends and kin, the only ones she had. They were Egypt. I do not do this for the king, she thought in wonder. I do it for Egypt.
Still silent, hissed Nahare furiously. By Amun, these rebels are madmen, all of them! Shadzar, come forth again!
Oh, Amun, I cannot stand another lashing now, thought Mara. Not yet. I must have time, a little time. Wait, she choked. I will tell you something, all I know. I have heard them say that he is not a scribe, this Sashai, but a sculptor, one who has worked on the great temple under the cliff. But I do not know his name, I swear it.
If that is so, I can find him easily enough,
put in Count Senmet. He stepped closer to Mara.
Describe him.
He is short, not much above my own height, with heavy shoulders and a girth it would take 2 sashes to go around. He wears a curled wig and has a scar on his chin.
Senmet straightened slowly, his eyelids drooping with disbelief.
I do not recall such a man among my crew of sculptors.
But I know him well. He is, as I say.
The queen's scornful laughter cut through her protest.
I think it is her fear of the lash that speaks, Senmet, not her memory. Is there no way to test this without sending to the city of the dead to rouse all the sculptors in Thebes from their couches and drag them here?
I know a way, your radiance, said Lord Nahere.
He walked past Mara to the main doors of the room, and muttered something to a soldier, who hurried out. Returning, Nahere remarked,
It will be but a moment, your majesty. As for you, girl, if you've not spoken truth this time, I hope you've made your peace with the gods.
How can he find out so surely, so soon, thought Mara. He's bluffing. There's no— Then she remembered the juggler. She sank back on her heels and let her head drop, her raw and aching shoulders turning to a mass of fire in protest against even that slight movement. She was still dizzy with the pain of it when she heard the door behind her open, the sound of someone falling to his knees, then Lord Nahere's cold voice.
Here's our testing stick, your radiance. Come forward, juggler. Pharaoh would question you.
The twisted, strangely graceful body glided past the corner of Mara's eye. The queen's voice rang in her ears.
You may speak to my majesty, juggler. I want the truth for once. Is the man called Sashai a short man, full of girth, with a curled wig and having a scar on his chin?
Sashai, echoed Sahure. And Mara's aching flesh quivered under the amusement in his tone.
Your eternal radiance, I would scarce describe him so, since he is tall and of a strength like a tree trunk, and without visible blemish. A young man he is, somewhat homely of countenance, though this bedraggled lily here found him handsome enough, I dare say.
Amun, deliver me from this wretch of a slave, gasped the queen, almost transformed by her fury. She has done naught but lie, naught but defy my majesty. You, Libyan.
Hatshepsut rose from her throne, and her voice rose to a shriek.
Come forward and teach this riffraff who it is she defies. Lay on, do you hear me? Beat her, beat her, beat her.
Shadzar was obeying already, and his blows grew heavier with every scream of his infuriated pharaoh. But the screams grew dim in Mara's ears. She swam for a few endless moments in a sea of fire, then faded slowly into a sea of black, where there was no pain.
Chapter 24. For Egypt. Nuit the Starry One, goddess of the sky, arched her spangled body over the land of Egypt and gazed down serenely on its sleeping thousands. In palace and villa and hovel they slept, long of eye, with their amulets about their necks, each stiffly pillowed on his headrest of wood or carven ivory or gold. The sailor slept on his vessel on the Nile, the priest in his temple cell, the beggar in his lane. The scent of lotuses and the river and the black earth rose like the very breath of night to delight Nuit's nostrils, and the cat slept, and the waterfowl slept, and the dead slept in their spices and wrappings, deep in the tomb. But not everyone slept. In Bubastis, in the north, a thief prowled the night. In Abydos, three surgeons worked over an old man who moaned in pain. And in Thebes, two men argued in tense and urgent whispers in an alley. The eyes of Nuit rested on these two with mild curiosity. One was young, dressed as a scribe, the other a burly riverman. They seemed agitated and in anxious haste. Presently they left their alley and moved swiftly, but with great caution, down another, glancing always from side to side as if searching for someone. Nuit became aware that there were other dark figures scattered throughout the alleys and byways of this particular area, hiding in twos or threes, sometimes venturing forth, also searching, until they found others. The scribe discovered one such group, joined it eagerly, and gave whispered orders, then hurried with his companion toward the river. There was a small papyrus boat bobbing against one of the ladders of the wharf, which Nuit had not deemed worth her notice, until the scribe and the riverman dropped into it and paddled in silent haste out across the Nile. The eye of Nuit was distracted. For a time she was engaged in admiring her own starry reflection in the dark mirror of the water. When she remembered the two men, they were already scrambling up the opposite bank and starting at a run through the streets of western Thebes. At a corner within sight of the palace wall, near a clump of acacia trees, they halted, held a brief conference, then separated. The riverman melted into the thick shadows under the acacias. The scribe made his way by lane and back alley into the district of great walled villas to the northwest. He was moving with the utmost caution now, and he grew warier the closer he approached a certain broad street lined with sycamore figs, and an estate of noble proportions which fronted on it. Nuit was pleased. The sycamore was sacred to her, and its glassy leaves mirrored her own beauty, as well as emitting the delicate, sharp scent most welcome to her nostrils. Because of the sycamores, she looked with favor on the estate, whose walls the scribe was circling stealthily, and smiled when he scaled the wall by means of its vines, slipped through a corner of the large date grove, and approached the great columned silent house set in its midst. She watched him until he gained an inner courtyard by the servant's wing and knocked softly on a door. Then the faint cry of a woman in Menfi reached Nuit's velvet dark ear, and remembering her duties as protectress of mothers and childbirth, for was she not the mother of great Osiris himself? She turned her attention to another drama.
Hieronymon, whispered Sheftu, knocking again and more insistently upon the door.
There was the sound of a startled movement within, then the old man's voice.
Who's there at this hour of the night? Wait, I'm coming.
In a moment, the door was opened a cautious crack. Then it swung wide, revealing an Hieronymon who looked strangely shrunken and fragile and bald as an egg, without his eye paint and elaborate wig.
Your lordship, he gasped, what is— Hush, let me in quickly.
Sheftu stepped into the room and silently closed the door, while the old man fumbled to light a lamp.
Hieronymon, has anyone been here tonight? Have you been disturbed?
Nay, my lord, none but that Midianite trader, earlier this evening come peddling his wines, as he does every—
No one else? You have seen no soldiers about?
Soldiers? Indeed, no. What would soldiers?
The lamp glowed into brightness now, and Eranamon turned to study his master's face by its light.
Your lordship, is there trouble? Does it mean something is wrong, that no soldiers have been here? Nay, it means all is unbelievably right, as yet. Oh, Amon, it means I have made a terrible mistake, perhaps a fatal one for a maid who still keeps silent even at this moment, under I know not what punishment. Quick, Eranamon, rouse one of the grooms. I want Ebony and the black mare hitched to my chariot within 5 minutes, and ready in the main courtyard.
Sheftu caught up the lamp from the old man's table, and shielding the flame with his hand, dashed through the servants' wing into the inner garden and up the stairs to the second floor of the main house. Once in his own room, he tore off his coarse scribe's garments and put on fine linen ones, with his costliest jeweled collar and a golden headcloth. By the time he reached the main courtyard, the black horses were harnessed and tossing their silken heads. Seizing the reins from a sleepy groom, Sheftu leaped into the chariot and snatched the whip from its holder.
"Your lordship, take care," begged Eranamon in a quaking voice, gripping the side of the chariot with both hands. "I fear for you. May I know where you are going?" "Aye, and you may know as well that I may never come back. I go to the palace, old friend, to stick my head in a noose. Pray to the Shining One that it will not tighten too soon."
Sheftu leaned to grip the old man's hand. Then he popped his whip, and the chariot plunged forward amid a clatter of hoofs, spun out of the imposing gates, and down the street of sycamores toward the palace. In Menfi, the baby had been born. A tiny man-child yelling lustily in the Egyptian night. Already the mother had tied a protective amulet about his wrist, and the father was hurrying to burn a pinch of incense for Nuit, the great mother, in gratitude for the safe birth. As its fragrance drifted upward to the nose of the starry one, she smiled serenely and allowed her lustrous eyes to move again to Thebes. She could not find the scribe now. In the great villa under the sycamores, she saw none but an old man in night clothes, standing alone by the gates with his bald head bowed in his hands. However, there was movement far away down the dark street, swift and reckless movement, and the clamor of hoofs. It was a chariot, driven full tilt by a young noble in a collar that rivaled Nuit's own star-gemmed throat, and his horses were black as her hair. She watched him with interest as he sped through one street and then another, and upon rounding the last corner beside the palace walls, pulled up short beside a clump of acacias she thought she remembered. Aye, it was the same, for out of its dark shelter darted the river captain, who held a hurried conference with the nobleman, then set off at a lumbering trot around the curve of the palace wall. The other whipped up his horses and drove straight for the main gate. His voice, bold and demanding, floated faintly to Nuit's faraway ear, and in a moment the palace gates swung open. At his barked order, the sentry snapped to attention, raising his sword to salute as the chariot flashed past him and whirled down the East Avenue. The starry one had seldom encountered a more impetuous young man, and she found herself pleased by him. She wondered where he had sent the riverman and to what purpose. After a brief search, she discovered the captain some distance to the west, pounding heavily at a door of the long barracks which housed the pharaoh's bodyguard. His answer was the flare of a lamp within. Then the door swung open. Nuit blinked rapidly at the light, causing a thousand stars to twinkle. To her disappointment, the captain stepped into the lighted room where her night-seeing eyes could no longer follow him.
"General Hofra?" panted Nekonk.
"I am he. What is it, man?"
"I bring the signal.
Lord Sheftu's orders, to be obeyed tonight at once. He bids you rouse your soldiers. At the mark of 4 exactly, they're to march on the palace, overpower the sentries first, and leave enough archers at the gates to hold off the regulars should they try to bring aid. Then...
Stay a moment, burst out the general incredulously. Tonight? The revolution's to take place tonight?
At the mark of 4, no later. Hearken, once in the palace, you're to send a detachment to the king's apartments, while you storm the throne room. Take plenty of men for that. We think the room's full of regulars. You've just half an hour. Hasten.
You must be mad, my friend. I can't do it that fast.
The gods willing, you can,
bellowed Nakank.
By Amun, you must. Lord Sheftu's walked into the lion's jaws, and he'll die like a trapped rat if we don't bring it off. He may anyway.
Nakank jammed his wig down more firmly onto his head and reached for the door latch.
What of the other factions?
Barked Khofra, who, in spite of his protests, was hurriedly buckling on his leather tunic.
The priesthood, the nobles who've sworn loyalty, the common folk, have they been roused?
That's where I'm going now, to rouse the nobles. I've comrades across the river doing the rest. By this time, the queen's high priest has fallen, if all's gone well, and there'll be a procession out of the temple at dawn, followed by the populace. They'll do their parts, never fear. But without your seasoned troops...
They're far from seasoned, Captain,
said the other grimly, seizing his helmet from a chair.
The thing's impossible, but
by every god in Egypt, I'll do my best. Luck go with you.
Nakank plunged out into the night again, as Khofra vanished down the long hall of the barracks to rouse his soldiers. Nuit did not see the captain emerge, for she was watching the young man in the shining collar. He had abandoned his chariot near the palace stables and set off at a run through a maze of gardens and courts. Ahead, in the direction he was running, lay the north wing of the Golden House and the great hall where the woman Hatshepsut, she who arrogantly claimed descent from Nuit's own glorious grandfather, Ra, the Shining One, was accustomed to hold her audiences. Something was happening in that hall. Something ugly. But there was too much torchlight for Nuit's dark-loving eyes to make out what it was. She felt a flicker of apprehension, quite unsuitable to a goddess, when she perceived that her bold young man was making straight for the anteroom that adjoined the hall. He passed into the mist of light that surrounded the portals. Then, to Nuit's disappointment, he, like the captain, vanished through a torch-lit door. She shrugged her starry shoulders. These scurrying mortals had amused her, but now she would spend what remained of the hours of darkness in admiring her beauty in the mirror of the Nile. She began to do so, but soon the urgent calling of a woman in the Delta recalled to her mind her age-old duties, and she forgot Thebes as she ushered another new Egyptian into the world. Mara swam up slowly out of her sea of dark oblivion. Someone was splashing cold water into her face and shaking her roughly. They will only beat me again, she thought, keeping her eyes shut. I'll pretend... But even as she planned it, she gasped and cringed as the hand touched her raw shoulders.
"She's but feigning now," said Nahere. "Up on your knees, you!"
But it was not his voice which forced her eyes wide open suddenly, jarred her whole mind alert. It was another voice, outside in the anteroom, and a stir among the soldiers who stood nearest the doors.
"Up on your knees, I said," repeated Nahere.
Then, impatiently,
"What is that? Who's outside there?"
"A noble who demands admittance, Excellence," mumbled one of the soldiers. "He seems most
"Let him in," commanded Hatshepsut. Mara raised herself to her knees, disregarding the pain the movement caused her. It couldn't be. It mustn't. But it was. The tall doors swung open, and an arrogant, gold-decked figure she had never thought to see again strolled through them and bowed with debonair grace toward the throne.
"Good evening, Radiant One. Excellencies, rejoice," remarked Lord Sheftu.
He did not glance at Mara, nor did she at him, after her first agonized recognition. Her attention froze on Sahure, whose sudden intent frown showed that it was only a matter of moments until the jeweled collar and golden headcloth would no longer confuse him. Had Sheftu noticed him? He must have, and he must be all but reeling from the shock of it.
Aye, why did he come? Thought Mara.
Whatever plan he'd had in mind, it was defeated before it began.
"You might rather say good morning," the queen was remarking irritably. "Have we turned night into day, or is it your habit, Lord Sheftu, to visit the palace at this hour? I supposed this audience was secret."
"Your Radiance, it is difficult to keep anything secret in the City of Thebes, when both servants and rivermen gossip like magpies, often with each other. I felt my place was by your Majesty's side. However," the smooth voice took on a note of amusement, "I seem to have overestimated the emergency. Where are the criminals, Daughter of the Sun? Surely my Lord Nahere's adroit and fearless coup netted more than one wretched slave girl."
"A poor catch, indeed, but all we have," returned the queen, frowning at Nahere, who had gone red with anger.
"And the stubborn wench has told us not."
"Perhaps she knows not," suggested Sheftu carelessly. "But whether she be innocent or guilty, your Majesty has been ill-advised in the manner of questioning her," he added, with a glance at Senmut. "The maid looks half-dead."
"Should she defy Pharaoh and go unpunished?" snarled Senmut.
"Nay, but on the other hand, of what value is her corpse?"
Mara listened breathlessly. By Amun, already he had contrived to make the whole matter seem vaguely ridiculous, and the Count and Lord Nahere a pair of fools. Could it be possible that—
Then she glanced at the juggler, and her heart sank. His narrowed eyes were gleaming. He had realized the truth. But would he dare accuse so great a lord? He could prove nothing.
"If your Majesty will allow me,"
Sheftu was saying easily,
"I might soothe the maid a little, tempt her with some small reward."
"Nay, we've tried at that. My Majesty offered her both gold and freedom. She scorned them."
"She scorned them?"
Sheftu was not acting now, and there was a note in his voice that stirred Mara to a deep, unreasonable joy. As if he could not believe what he had heard, he repeated, "She refused a bribe?"
"Aye, she did, the wretch."
There was a little silence, and when Sheftu spoke again, his voice shook almost imperceptibly.
"In that case, naught on earth can unseal her lips. Perhaps, after all, she knows nothing." "And perhaps she knows much."
It was a new voice, Sahure's.
It rang loud and derisive through the room.
"But you know more, Sashai."
Every head jerked toward the juggler, still crouched on his knees, but now pointing a long, accusing finger at Lord Sheftu.
"How dare you speak without permission?" gasped the queen.
Sheftu went on at once, as if good breeding alone forbade him to notice an outrageous interruption.
"And if she knows not, your Majesty?"
"Wait!" cried Count Senmut. "Let the juggler speak. Did he say Sashai?"
"I did, Lion of Courage and Wisdom. That
is Sashai, he who stands before you in fine raiment and gold. He is the scribe of the falcon. The same, the same!"
The queen rose to her feet.
"What is this babble? Do you know of whom you speak, insolent fool? That is Lord Sheftu, son of Menkau, the friend of kings, and my trusted courtier.
He is also Sashai, your magnificence. He is the same, I swear it."
Sheftu's amused voice broke in.
"Who is this madman? He intrigues me."
"Of course he's mad," cried the queen. "He offends my majesty. Take him away, Nehere."
"Your radiance, wait."
Count Senmut stepped forward, and the harsh furrows of his smile deepened slowly in his face as he studied Sheftu.
"Surely my lord would be even more intrigued if this juggler could prove his claims. That would be amusing, would it not? Speak, juggler, have you proof?"
"I have, Lion of Wisdom."
The queen stiffened. Nehere pulled the juggler toward him, and Mara caught her breath in sharp and sudden fear.
"You can prove this accusation?" burst out Nehere. "Speak, then, quickly."
"Let His Highest Excellence the Architect look upon the left wrist of the great Lord Sheftu."
"Oh, Amun, it's over, it's all over, he's lost," thought Mara. And the fragile bubble of hope that had been growing in her burst all in an instant.
"What will I find there?"
asked Count Senmut, moving toward Sheftu stealthily, like a great cat.
"An amulet of strange design, Highest Excellence. I have not seen it this night, for his wrist is hidden from me here where I kneel. Nevertheless, I will describe it to you, for I know it well. Aye, well, from the wrist of Sashai."
"Describe it, then."
Sedmut seized Sheftu's wrist, and hiding it from the juggler with his own body, stared down at it.
"It is a twist of flax thread strung with 7 green beads, and knotted 7 times. There is a flat bead of carnelian in the midst of the 7, inscribed on both sides. Is it not as I say, Excellence?"
Slowly, the architect's eyes climbed up to rest on Sheftu's immobile face.
"It is as you say."
He flung Sheftu's wrist down.
"Here is your traitor, Radiant One, the incorruptible Sheftu!"
"Osiris," whispered the queen, dropping back upon her throne.
"It cannot be! It cannot be!"
For Mara, time itself seemed to halt. Then Sheftu sighed, shrugged, and turned to Count Senmut.
"So it is over, comrade," he said. "We had best admit everything, had we not? But it is sad that in spite of all our precautions..."
"We?"
Senmut was staring at him, suddenly ashen.
"Great Amun, what are you saying?" Hatshepsut fairly screamed. "Do you tell me that Count Senmut, too?"
The architect whirled to her.
"Majesty, it is a lie! He but seeks to drag me down with him!"
"Radiant One, you do not believe..."
"Oh, come," put in Sheftu coolly. "The game's over. We've been comrades. Let us die like men."
"Curse you! You'll die like a rat, here and now."
Senmut sprang upon him savagely. A knife flashed upward, only to clash upon another that seemed to leap of itself into Sheftu's fist. In an instant, the room was pandemonium. Nehere's cloak fanned Mara as he rushed forward. Hatshepsut was on her feet, shrieking orders that brought soldiers flying from every corner of the room. Mara, torn between terror and wild elation, found herself standing erect, hurling defiance at all of them at the top of her voice. Then the knot of soldiers around the two men burst apart. Nehere staggered back, and there was Sheftu, held fast by 2 soldiers, with his fine robe torn, but his eyes flashing. On the floor at his feet sprawled the body of Count Senmut.
"So," breathed Hatshepsut, "one is gone,
and the other shall follow." Her voice rose with fury. "You stand condemned of treason and murder, my lord Sheftu. At sunrise, you die."
"And my secret's with me," taunted Sheftu.
The queen's features seemed to freeze. For the first time, Mara saw a glint of real fear in her eyes.
"What mean you? There are others?"
Sheftu laughed softly, and Pharaoh rose as if the sound itself drew her to her feet.
"Cease this mockery! What secrets?"
"Aye, what? And when is it to happen, and who will do it? Count your hours, Hatshepsut, for there are few left, and you will not enjoy them. Who can you point to now and say with confidence, 'He is my friend'? Your court is full of traitors, and you know them not. But I know them."
He is gambling for time, thought Mara, on what frail hope she could not imagine. He was taking one last chance, playing on the queen's one weakness, her fear for her throne. And he was doing it as skillfully as a harpist plucks his strings. Hatshepsut was standing rigid, with panic in her eyes.
"What traitors?" she cried.
"Their names die with me."
"And their plans as well. Son of the Devourer, what can they do without their leader?"
"My death will be as nothing to them. It will be as a stone thrown into the Nile in the time of inundation. Do the waters stop for a stone? The plans are made, Hatshepsut, and the hour is near. You will know your enemies when they strike."
For an instant, Hatshepsut's face was sickening to gaze upon. Then, slowly, she straightened, and something of her cold beauty returned as she forced herself under control. She sat down slowly, stiffly, and grasped the arms of her throne.
"Lord Sheftu," she said, "let us approach this in a different manner. Why go to your death when you might serve me in Count Senmut's place, when you might own the choice lands that were his tax-free? When you might be the most powerful man in Egypt. All this I could give you, or more, whatever you asked. Surely there is some treasure you crave."
Sheftu hesitated, and a gleam of triumph appeared in Hatshepsut's eyes. At last he said,
"Aye, there is, Majesty."
The queen let out her breath slowly and relaxed, leaning back with a faint smile, twisting her lips.
"Soldiers, release his lordship," she commanded.
The men loosed their hands and stepped back. Sheftu stood free. At once he turned, strode quickly to Mara, and took her in his arms. Mara, in a rapturous confusion at the unexpectedness of it, barely heard the queen's outraged exclamation. But she felt with all her heart the gentleness with which Sheftu held her, taking care not to touch her blood-stained shoulders, and she heard his murmur in her ear.
"Oh, Mara, my beloved Mara, I would I could save thee, but they come not, and it will soon be too late."
"Who comes?" she whispered.
But the queen's mocking laughter cut in.
"This is your treasure, Lord Sheftu?"
"Aye, the greatest treasure in Egypt. A maid whose loyalty cannot be bought. Whatever bargain we make, daughter of the sun, must include her freedom."
Mara did not see what signal the queen made to the soldiers. But suddenly she and Sheftu were jerked apart and held fast, and Hatshepsut was on her feet, her voice lashing at them.
"We will make no bargain. Nehere, bring forth your Libyan and instruct him to beat this maid to death before his lordship's eyes. Unless, did you wish to speak, Lord Sheftu?"
Mara flashed him a terrified glance and saw that Hatshepsut had found her weapon at last. All Sheftu's cool poise had shattered in an instant. He was fighting his captors like a madman.
though his lips were shut tight. "Begin, Libyan," ordered Hatshepsut. The lash curled through Shadzar's fingers like a lazy black serpent, then struck. The pain was nauseating. Through it, Mara heard Sheftu's furious voice, and though she could not understand what he said, she screamed out, "Don't speak! Don't speak! It will not last long!" It would not last long at all, she thought dimly, as the lash came down again. Already the blackness was closing in. She had had too much. After the next blow, she would feel nothing. But the next blow never fell. For an instant, she could not distinguish the strange new sound she was hearing from the roaring in her own ears. Then she realized this new roar came from outside. Men were running, shouting, and suddenly Hatshepsut was crying out orders in a strange, hoarse voice, and Mara felt herself dumped like a discarded burden as the soldiers leaped over her and ran. The big doors burst open. Mara struggled painfully to rise, staring about her at the wildest confusion. Soldiers were everywhere, pouring into the room in endless streams, clashing in hand-to-hand combat with those ranged around Hatshepsut, who stood screaming orders before her throne. Nehere fell as Mara watched, and the gnarled old general, who had struck him down, whirled as the juggler crept past toward the inner door, seized him, flung him bodily into the arms of two archers. A shadow fell across her. "Mara! Oh, Amun, no hand but mine shall slay that misbegotten Libyan!" Sheftu scooped her up, cursing incoherently, carried her to the far side of the room, and thrust her into a pair of strong and sheltering arms she recognized with wonder as Nakank's. As Sheftu whirled away again, she heard the captain's comforting growl in her ear.
"Now, little one, all's well at last. Everything's out of our hands. Our task is done. Rest, little blue eyes."
He flung his cloak about her, and with a deep sigh of gratitude, Mara buried her face in the rough folds of his tunic, and shut her ears to the noise of conflict, and shut her eyes. When she opened them, she knew not how much later, all was strangely quiet. She twisted about in Nakank's arms, which instantly loosened, and for a moment had the peculiar sensation that she was back with Inanni, in Hatshepsut's formal court. Once more the big room glittered with the jeweled collars of courtiers. But now the walls behind them were lined thick with soldiers, those wearing the scarlet helmets of Pharaoh's bodyguard. The courtiers, headed by Sheftu, stood in two ranks down the length of the room. At one end of the open aisle thus formed was the dais, the great throne, and Hatshepsut standing motionless and stiffly erect, with her black hair falling in a cloud about her cold and beautiful face, and the cobra on her brow. At the other end, approaching her with the stride of a conqueror, came the long-fettered king. Thutmose stopped before the throne and spoke.
"Come down."
There was a pause, during which not a head moved, not a finger stirred. Then, slowly, haughtily, Hatshepsut descended the steps of the dais and stood before him. He reached out and jerked the coronet of Egypt from her head. Then, still without turning his eyes from hers, he beckoned someone in the crowd. A servant stepped forward, bearing a tray on which rested a golden cup full of some dark liquid. For just a moment, Hatshepsut's gaze wavered, as she looked at the cup. Then it returned unflinchingly to Thutmose. "You show little mercy, half-brother," she said bitterly.
"I show much. I grant you leave to die by your own hand rather than another's. Take the cup and drink."
Hatshepsut was silent, and the mask of youth fell suddenly from her face.
"So be it. I will drink and forget.
But you will not forget, nor will these others, though you chisel my cartouche from every monument in the Double Kingdom. My works stand, son of the Lesser Wife, and they will eclipse yours and your sons and those of all pharaohs after me, so long as the land of Egypt is watered by the Nile. You cannot kill the name of Hatshepsut the Glorious. Now, give me the cup. But I am Pharaoh, and I will not drink it here, in the presence of my enemies. Stand aside, that I may pass. With a sweep of her fragile, flowing robes, Hatshepsut turned and bore the golden cup to her private chambers. Thutmose followed her. The door closed quietly behind them. A sound, like a sigh, passed through the crowd in the throne room, but no one stirred from his place, though Sheftu turned to seek Mara's eyes across the space that separated them. It seemed a long time before the inner door opened again, and Thutmose stepped forth, alone. At the sight of the royal cobra on his brow, the entire company fell to their knees. But the king walked straight to Sheftu, raised him, and grasped his shoulders in both hands. There was a low conversation, unheard by any save themselves. Then both turned toward Mara, and Sheftu quickly crossed the space of blood-stained floor and took her hand.
"Beloved, come with me, unless your hurt is too great."
Conscious of 100 eyes upon her, Mara followed him painfully, but with pounding heart, down the double line of kneeling courtiers to the king.
"So," said Thutmose, in the gentlest tone she had ever heard him use, "it is the little interpreter who has saved Egypt and me this night."
He was silent a moment, then lifted his hand to touch his lips and forehead in the salute of respect.
"Blue-eyed one, never again shall you cover your shoulders. I declare your scars to be medals of gallantry greater than any I could bestow. And it is my will that all the black land look upon them and learn the nature of courage."
Gravely, he lifted a massive gold chain from his own neck and placed it around Mara's.
"Count, Sheftu,"
he added, raising his voice so that it carried to all parts of the room,
"I advance your status to nearest friend and advisor of Pharaoh. Your place is at my right hand as long as I rule Egypt. But I charge you now, leave me and find the most skilled physician in Thebes to treat this maid's wounds. Farewell, and the gods go with you."
He turned away from them, and as they moved once more down the long room, they heard his confident and vigorous step advancing toward the throne. A moment later, his voice rang out,
"In the name of Ra, the Shining One, and of my father, whose royal will decreed it, I claim my heritage as Pharaoh of the Two Lands and sole ruler of Egypt."
Chapter 25. The Street of Sycamores. Outside, the night was soft, the air dark and cool and fragrant. Mara walked with Sheftu past the archers guarding the entrance, across the stone drive, and through the gate of the Lotus Garden. There, Sheftu stopped at once and took her with infinite care into his arms. He kissed her lingeringly, in silence, then tilted her chin and looked down into her face.
"Sheftu," she whispered, "it's all over."
"Nay, little one, it's just beginning. Many things are beginning."
With one arm still about her waist, he led her on across the dewy grass, and with every step Mara's heart grew lighter until even the pain in her torn shoulders seemed a thing of the past.
"Where are we going?" she asked presently. "To find the physician?"
"My lovely Mara, the physician about to be lifted above his station in life will come to you, and relate to his grandchildren how he did so."
Mara laughed softly, delightedly. And he must be the best in Thebes. You heard Pharaoh's order. Then I suppose we are going to my room with the butterflies, which I never thought to see again. Hi, of course. I must wake my princess and tell her. You will send her home, Sheftu, as you promised. Without her help, I could never have...
Hush. We'll tell her tomorrow, and she may sail as far as she likes. But we are not going to her now, little one. You're going home with me for the rest of your life.
Sheftu, is it true? I can scarce believe it. Mara stopped walking and looked at him wonderingly. You're a count now, and I a free maid.
A free maid, and about to become a countess.
Sheftu grinned down at her.
I trust, he added, that you will remember to keep your sandals on.
And if I choose not to, she retorted. He laughed softly, taking her face between his hands.
Then you shall go barefoot. Who shall dare cross the will of the countess, except the count?
He dropped a kiss on her lips, then his smile faded, and his arms went around her as if never to let her go.
Oh, Mara, Mara, nay, I'm hurting you. We must go on, beloved.
A countess, thought Mara dreamily, as they moved across the grass into the Avenue of Rams and on toward the palace stables. I shall be a countess and possess anything I like and eat roasted waterfowl every day and wear rings on my fingers and have lotuses, always a fresh one, for my hair, all just as I boasted to Teta. Except it will be better than that, oh, much better, for I shall be with Sheftu. They had reached the stables, and Sheftu was rapping out orders that produced hasty activity among the grooms. Soon, a wide door opened, and four Nubians hurried out, bearing a canopied litter far grander than those Mara had made way for so often in the streets of Menfi. I am glad, she murmured, that it is not a chariot. She was beginning to feel like a countess already, as she stepped into the litter and eased her sore shoulders back against its luxurious cushions. Aye, surely I was destined for this at birth, she thought, trailing her fingers along the rich carving of the armrest and crossing her ankles in exquisite imitation of Zasha's lady. If Teta could see me now. Why, I will soon forget I was ever a slave in my life, and no one else will know. I shall wear royal linen and perhaps a blue wig. She extended a gracious hand to Sheftu as he sank down beside her, and to her delight he bent over it gallantly. And now, Count Sheftu, she inquired, could you describe me as a gutter snipe?
To be sure,
he said pleasantly. She sat bolt upright. Sheftu! He was laughing under his breath as he lifted her hand again to his lips.
A countess, Guttersnipe, he amended. Far more interesting, lotus-eyed one, than a lady born. See now, you were too impulsive. You have hurt your shoulders.
He eased her back against the cushions, one arm about her. The chair lifted, moved at a swift but gentle jog down the long avenue, through the tall main gate, and into streets beginning to gray with the first light of morning. For a time, Mara was content with silence and blissful comfort. But a thought was stirring in the back of her mind which she could not put away. Sheftu, she said, when I am your countess, may I have anything I want?
Anything, little one.
He glanced at her, then added, within reason. Mara grinned, savoring again the flavor of their old dueling at the Falcon. I only want you to buy me a slave.
A slave?
Aye, one called Teta, who was left one day in Menfi with a basket of unironed shenties she did not deserve.
You shall have her, blue-eyed one, but my villa is full of slaves. What do you want of another?
I want to free her. Sheftu smiled, took her hand, and settled back beside her.
So be it. That is a small matter, to free a slave. Have we not freed a king?
A moment later, he dropped her hand to point.
Look, Mara, ahead there. Those are our gates.
Eagerly, Mara sat erect and peered through the swaying curtains. They were moving down a broad street lined with sycamores toward the imposing gates of a great white wall. Beyond the wall, she could see groves and a spreading roof, the plumes of tall palms waving in the breeze. And still beyond, over all, shone the clear pink sky of morning. Even as the chair passed under the last sycamore and through the gates, a great procession of chanting, scarlet-robed priests was winding up the East Avenue toward the palace, trailing the fragrance of myrrh. Nuit, the Great Mother, making her stately way westward to the dark of the underworld, paused at the perfume and the joyous noise, and glanced over a starry shoulder. Something unusual was happening in the Black Land, but her duties were over, and she was sleepy. She moved away, blinking, as the great doors of the throne room were thrown open and the procession passed inside, followed by a throng of cheering, white-clad Thebans who filled the streets and ferries and wharfs as far back as she could see. Then the stars went out, for the bark of Ra, in fiery splendor, burst out of the east. Sunshine flooded the wide desert and the long green valley of the Nile. The night was over. A new day had dawned for the land of Egypt. This is Tara Sands. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Mara, Daughter of the Nile by Eloise Jarvis McGraw. This program was directed by Andrea Kaufman. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Text copyright, 1953, by Eloise Jarvis McGraw. Copyright renewed, 1981, by Eloise Jarvis McGraw. Production copyright, 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.